Hi, Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, John Lennon, Elvis Presley, Kurt Cobain, and Jerry Garcia. Their deaths had much in common, and surprisingly, so did their lives. David Comfort of Santa Rosa, California, is the author of three best-selling nonfiction books, the recipient of several literary prizes. He was a finalist for the Nelson Algren Award and America's Best. His newest book is called The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead. It is published by Citadel Press. You could visit the website, rockandrollbookofthedead.com. And David Comfort, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Good to be with you, Jim.
You're a former musician, have spent three decades studying rock music, particularly the pioneers of the 60s. What got you started on that?
Well, of course, I adore their music. I mean, all these people are a bit of, they're kind of my musical heroes. I grew up in that era.
Mm-hmm.
And I was particularly fascinated with them because there was a strange duality in all of them, of incredible creativity, and yet underneath that, the other side of the coin was the self-destructiveness. And it's not peculiar simply to them. I mean, we can look in other arts and painting and writing and et cetera. You find often very, very creative people have that duality. You know, the creative on the one hand and the self-destructive on the other. And I wanted to sort of examine that. Why exactly is that? Get as close as I could to plumbing that mystery. The other thing that really fascinated me is super fame. I mean, not just celebrity, but super fame to the extent that you're a living legend. What sort of impact that has on you as an individual? And of course, it's a very negative impact. It's incredibly destructive. Most people cannot live with that kind of pressure. And I wanted to examine that too. So that theme is basically the toxicity of super fame.
Mm-hmm. Of these seven, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, John Lennon, Elvis, Kurt Cobain, and Jerry Garcia, did most have premonitions of an early death?
They did indeed. That was another uncanny similarity between all of them. Perhaps Garcia was an exception to that, but all the others pretty much yes. There was an uncanny aspect to Lennon's because he had no reason to really believe that. When he made that controversial statement early on, you know, in 66, that the Beatles are more popular than Jesus Christ, he started getting death threats. And, of course, he got very paranoid about it, and he was told by some clairvoyance that he might be shot in the U.S. in 66. But even before that, he felt like he just might not live a full life, and many of the others felt that way, particularly Morrison, Janis, and Cobain. With Morrison and Janis, they were overindulging to such an extent that it was almost inevitable that they were going to die early, and they were almost okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the peculiar thing about them. I mean, Jimmy Page once said, and he was another of Led Zeppelin who thought he was going to die early, "One day as a lion, much better than 100 days or 100 years as a lamb." This is the way they wanted to live, burning the candle at both ends, which involved, well, in a sense, these people died not of self-destruction, but of an overdose of life. They were insatiables. It was never enough for them, whether it was drugs or whatever. And, I mean, they were living outside the speed limit, and there's the piper to be paid at the end of that for many people.
Did all seven of them become addicts?
They did. They did indeed. Many people think, of course, well, Elvis didn't, but he was a pharmaceutical addict.
Yeah.
Far more developed, probably than the others. I mean, the amount of pharmaceutical morphines and narcotics he was taking were truly superhuman. The thing that's really stunning about all these people, not just yet Elvis, is they didn't die even earlier than they did. Even the 27-year-olds, and there were four of them, Morrison, Janis, Hendrix, and Cobain, they were taking just enormous quantities of drugs, and a normal person probably would have died earlier.
You know, it's kind of funny when you think about Michael Jackson and his death and the amount of drugs that were supposedly involved.
Yeah.
It was really nothing when you think of his former father-in-law, Elvis,
exactly.
who had this just monstrous appetite for drugs and for food.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, they were. Elvis was a true insatiable, like many of the others. And Michael Jackson took it one step further. I mean, it's almost a star chemotherapy, narcotics, heroin. I mean, when you're under that kind of pressure, the only thing that will remove you from that smithy, you know, that pressure cooker, is heroin. And Jackson went one further. He went to general anesthetics, you know, propofol, which is quite stunning.
David Comfort is our guest. He's the author of The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead. It's published by Citadel Press, and you can visit his website for lots of information, rockandrollbookofthedead.com. And we're talking about a wild ride to the other side of fame. The dreams of the 60s were shattered with the assassination of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. And in the midst of this, the cry of freedom was taken up by a new political animal, the rock star. And before that, it wasn't quite the same as the emergence of this rock star in the turbulent 60s.
Yeah, the rock star for some reason became the lightning rod of the 60s and almost the representative of the rebel, you know, outside the establishment and all the rest. And, you know, previously, well, Elvis Presley started and all the rest, but I mean, you consider the previous generation of Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby and all the rest. It seems like such benign music, and this and rock and roll is so explosive and so volatile and so energy filled, unlike all the rest of it. And rebellion was a great part of that, but there was a dark aspect of that as well as a light aspect, you know. And so these people, they became stars not just for their music, but the way they lived their lives. There was little distinction between the way they performed on stage and the way they lived their lives. It was just completely over the top and completely rebellious.
If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions or comments about the seven featured in the Rock and Roll Book of the Dead, then the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. Is the ultimate irony, then, the more famous the stars became, the more isolated, lonely, and self-destructive they also became?
Yeah, in many ways that's true. The isolation was enormous, of course. I mean, take Michael Jackson. I mean, he was always saying that too, like the others did. I mean, you just don't know who you can trust anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure the people around you, even the closest people, your lovers, may be in there for another reason than actually loving you, you know, for their own gain. And it was certainly true of those seven. So it was enormously isolating. Which is so ironic, because millions and millions of people adored these people, loved these people, and yet they found so little love in their own lives. Another irony is that all of them, of course, had many, many relationships, and they all had people in the beginning and even in the middle who truly loved them for the human being that they were, not the star that they were. The irony is that they tended to abandon these people who really loved them, and they gravitated to the people who turned out to be the ones who did use them, you know, and mm-hmm. helped bring them down.
When John Lennon was shot to death, he had just completed what I understand was a 5-year house husband hibernation.
Yes.
To get away from his fans. He just stayed in the Dakota for all that time.
Yes. Well, there were some trips to Japan and stuff like that with mm-hmm. Yoko, but by and large, yeah, it was a reclusive period. But I think what's generally misunderstood about that period is John and Yoko painted that period as just, you know, get off the merry-go-round and recharge your batteries and all the rest and all the craziness. But the fact is that John Lennon was really pretty creatively dead during that period, and it pretty much ate him alive. I mean, especially watching his colleagues from the Beatles prosper, especially Paul McCartney, you know, coming out with many hits, mm-hmm. and John was pretty dry. And it was a very, very difficult period for him, and he was consuming a lot of drugs as a result. And Double Fantasy was, of course, the epiphany after that, in 80 when he suddenly became very fertile again and enthusiastic and all the rest. But, of course, as we know, that was very short-lived.
As I understand it, he feared making decisions of any sort and relied on Yoko to use seers, clairvoyants, fortune tellers to determine what their next moves would be.
Yeah, he did. That's another peculiar thing. Well, John Lennon, in explaining that, he was very much aware of that—that he was hesitant about making any kind of decisions. He traced that back to when he was 5 years old, and he was living—he was living with his mother, of course, Julia, and his father was a merchant marine, and he came back from a long cruise, and because he hadn't been there for very long, been at home for very long, and the father wanted to move to New Zealand, and he basically gave the family a Sophie's Choice, or John Lennon at the age of five. He said, "John, I want to move to New Zealand. Your mother doesn't. Who are you going to go with? Are you going to stay in England with your mother? You're going to come with me." And John was utterly traumatized because he was completely, dependent on his parents, and he didn't know what to do, you know. So as a result, he stayed with his mother. His father thought abandoned him. He really didn't, but he didn't see his father for some years. But he felt a strong sense of abandonment from his father, and his mother was a very different type. She was a very frivolous, carefree woman, and his Aunt Mimi took over his upbringing because she was the stern disciplinarian. So he felt, in turn, that not only his father abandoned him, but his mother, too. And just in the world itself, he felt he wanted somebody else to make the decisions for him, and Yoko was certainly that person. She was very much of a mother figure for him. In fact, he did call her mother. But the irony is Yoko, for him, started out as a true mother figure, like Julia, frivolous and fun and all the rest, and she turned into the stern disciplinarian, almost like Mimi did. There's strange psychologies going on here, I think.
We're talking with David Comfort of Santa Rosa, California, who is the author of three best-selling nonfiction books, the recipient of several literary prizes, a finalist for the Nelson Algren Award and America's Best, and his newest book is called The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead. It's published by Citadel Press. You can visit the website for more information at rockandrollbookofthedead.com. We're going to continue talking with David about the lives of Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Kurt Cobain, and Jerry Garcia after we check on the latest news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us today. We're talking with David Comfort of Santa Rosa, California, about his book, The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead. It's published by Citadel Press, and it discusses the lives of Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, John Lennon, Elvis Presley, Kurt Cobain, and Jerry Garcia. One of the things that I noticed is the question about Jimi Hendrix and whether he took a fatal dose of barbiturates and alcohol or whether they were forced on him. Any opinion either way?
Naturally, it's impossible to know for sure because the only witness there or witnesses seem to be dead. This of course was in London, and he was cohabiting with his latest mistress of maybe 3 or 4 days, a woman by the name of Monica Daneman. And she was the one who had the secondol, so he took her secondol. Now, whether he did it intentionally or not, no one knows. He took 9 of them. Now, maybe he took one. He had a lot of trouble, like all the rest of them, in sleeping, you know, so he needed sleep aids. He may have taken several, and then 7 or whatever could have been administered to him later. But there was a good deal of motive from his manager to kill him, and I'm quite convinced that his manager did kill him. Let me give you a little background on the manager. It's almost true, stranger than fiction. Is a guy by the name of Mike Jeffrey, and he was originally, before he got into rock and roll management, an MI6 assassin for the British, the equivalent of the British CIA.
Mm-hmm.
during the Cold War, and he was a demolition expert, and he knew all the ropes, and he transferred that expertise almost to rock and roll management, and people were pretty terrified of him. You didn't cross the guy. He started his biggest act before Hendrix was the Animals. And the Animals felt quite certain that he was ripping them off and extorting almost all of their money and taking them to offshore accounts. And Eric Burdon precautioned Hendrix about that, a good friend of his. And Hendrix felt that, oh, well, you know, he's a tough guy and rock is a tough business. I'll watch him, and he could be an asset. Well, he was a good asset at first, but he drove Hendrix and the Experience at a demonic pace, 150 gigs a year until they were absolutely exhausted. And he wanted to push them further. They needed a vacation very badly, and Jimi Hendrix was fed up. He wanted to cash in the Experience, but the Experience was Jeffrey's cash cow. He couldn't let that happen. And so when Hendrix ultimately decided he needed to fire Mike Jeffries because he was extorting all this money, Mike Jeffries couldn't have that happen because he'd go to prison. You know, all the contracts would be reviewed, yeah. Money and all the rest. And so it all came to a climax that September in London. And I'm quite certain that he he confessed later to one of the roadies for the Experience, but there's so much circumstantial evidence that he was indeed involved that I think it's quite persuasive.
Let's go to the phones to Tom in Geyserville. Is that California?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I was wondering what light came on. What was the inspiration to tie all these artists together?
Well, I wanted to put together what I considered, and many others do, the biggest living legends in rock and roll during the classic period, late 50s to 60s, and into the 90s with Cobain and all the rest. People will argue, and they have. Other people think, you know, Brian Jones should have been in, Marvin Gaye, a few other people. But it is a subjective call. To me, these people, these seven people, were at the epitome, really, in terms of being living legends. And as I was discussing before, that's what really interested me. What this does to a human being, particularly a very hypersensitive artist, when you are in the eye of the storm and when you are a cultural icon. That's why I chose the seven. And this whole dichotomy between the creativity and the self-destructiveness, and then the pressure. In addition to that,
Tom, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
All right. Appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join in, the number is 800-642-1234. You may be listening on your radio or you may be listening on your computer. Either way, it's 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jill in Racine next. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I have a comment about Ellis. I read his autopsy, or one of them, and he was so bloated from all the medications he took, and he died of a massive heart attack. He was just bloated with all the toxins. The question I have is, I know Janis, you don't hear much about Janis, and I know she liked Jack Daniels and who knows what else, but I
well it wasn't Jack Daniels, it was Southern Comfort.
Yeah.
Oh, Southern Comfort.
Southern Comfort gave her $2,500 just because she was an unofficial spokesperson.
Oh, how could I forget that? I really like.
But Janis was, you know, in addition to loving Southern Comfort, she loved heroin, and there's a peculiar thing about heroin addicts. They have a very peculiar sort of diet. They love junk food. They love candy. You know, it rots your teeth, it rots your insides, and all the rest. So in addition to all the pharmaceutical stuff that was going on inside, she was on the downward slide, just, you know, nutritionally, let's put it that way. Elvis, yeah, indeed, he died of a heart attack. I mean, many people do. That's the immediate cause of the death. But it was almost certainly anaphylactic shock from a drug overdose. And the key to that, I mean, there were 11 major narcotics in his system, which he took all the time. But the straw that broke the camel's back was a whole bottle of codeine. There were 23 times the average pharmaceutical level in his liver and kidneys, and the codeine kicked it over the top because he was allergic to codeine. He knew that, and so one has to wonder: did he indeed do this intentionally? Did he commit suicide? And I addressed that question.
Jill, thank you for the call. One thing I couldn't help but notice was that Elvis's diet, his daily diet. He started off with lots of bacon in the morning, and he finished up with even more bacon for supper.
He did. Well, he wasn't insatiable to start with, but he became even more insatiable later in life because he was taking enormous quantities of cortisone for his lupus. And it wasn't well known in the 70s. I mean, cortisone was known as a miracle drug back then, and indeed it is in moderation, but it isn't known now that when you take such enormous quantities, you can become suicidal. The mood swings are tremendous. But apropos of his weight, it causes an absolutely insatiable hunger, you know. And coupled with the narcotics, of course, narcotics are very constipating, he bloated.
Mm-hmm. He was up around 300 pounds when he...
He was close to it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Janis Joplin, we talked about her. She was attempting to kick a heroin addiction when she died. And
yeah.
Jim Morrison, one of her paramours, died of a fatal overdose of heroin in Paris.
Yes.
So heroin just seems to be the key between some of these artists.
It is. Well, one of the big keys here is that heroin, usually not in and of itself, many ODs on heroin, the majority are when you mix it with other things, especially alcohol. That's really a toxic combination, and that happened in the cases of Morrison and Janis. Had they just taken the heroin and not been had a lot of alcohol in their system, they may very well not have overdosed. And both, well, especially Janis. I mean, she had overdosed numerous times in the past. I believe about six times,
mm-hmm.
and almost lost her life. And as her biographers say, she was chronically playing Russian roulette. You know, she just always took it to the max.
Jerry Garcia was another musician with a heroin habit.
Yes, he was. He tried to distinguish himself from the others by saying, "I'm not an out of control or excessive user. I'm just a sustenance user." He didn't die of heroin of a heroin overdose per se, but after 20 years of being a heroin addict, it certainly took its toll out on him. He never, you know, two broad differences in heroin use. You know, they're the shooters and they're the snorters, basically. The snorters are more the dilettantes. You know, the shooters are the serious ones, and that's when you can get in trouble with ODs and all the rest. But actually, Garcia was a smoker. He called it chasing the dragon. He smoked Persian heroin. And it took a good deal more to get high that way than mainlining, as Janis did.
Jerry's cholesterol at one time was over 900.
It was just a monster. And right at that period, which is I believe it was 1986, he went into a coma, anaphylactic shock, and then a coma, and he was in it for several days in San Francisco, and he clinically died, apparently, according to his wife, Mountain Girl. He flatlined for almost a minute. She blames the doctors that they overdosed him on Valium. Now, whatever the case, who knows exactly, but he miraculously, I mean, it was almost like a resurrection that he actually came out of it and lived. And after his coma, he couldn't play guitar. He couldn't walk. He could hardly even talk. It took him several months of playing guitar like a beginner, learning over and over again, an E chord, a C chord. He got back on the road within 4 months, which is absolutely miraculous.
We're talking with David Comfort about his book, The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead. Obviously, it's got a close approximation to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Is there relationship here other than Jerry Garcia?
Well, speaking of Garcia, I mean, Garcia in particular was a student of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. You might call him informally a Tibetan Buddhist. I mean, he was a very, very spiritual guy, as were the others, in fact. All of them were very familiar with the book, and including Elvis, which comes as a surprise. But he was a voracious reader in the occult and in all disciplines of religion. Morrison knew it quite well, being quite the intellectual. But the point is, with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is these people did not regard death as like the terminator, the end. You know, they regarded it as a transition, as the Tibetans did, and in a sense, many of them were not really afraid of death. I mean, John Lennon himself said that. He composed Tomorrow Never Knows, based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and he said it's just like getting out of one car and into another. It's simply a transition.
Let's go to Alan in Wautoma next. Alan, what can we do for you?
What about Jim Croce?
Jim Croce.
You know, you mean including him instead of one of the others in the seven, or maybe making him an eighth? I'm not that well informed on Jim Croce, but he didn't seem to be the driven, self-destructive star that the others did. Of course, he died in the airplane, and it didn't seem like it was a self-induced sort of tragedy. He seemed to be much more of a normal person, if you can say that, much less compulsive, I believe. He didn't quite fit into the same genre as these seven did, but he was a giant, certainly huge.
We talked earlier about Jim Morrison and a fatal overdose of heroin, but the thing that strikes me is that he was a participant in the early experiments of LSD in California.
Yes, he was.
Took massive amounts of LSD.
When he was going to the UCLA school in cinematography, he became one of the guinea pigs at UCLA Hospital for ingesting acid, and he used some pseudonyms too, so he could get more. I mean, one of his heroes was Nietzsche, another was Schopenhauer, and he would come to the hospital and use those names. So yeah, he was monitored under very therapeutic circumstances, but. He like many of the others, had a monster acid habit, like, early on. But the odd thing about the transitions in their drugs, it went from hallucinogens, like mind openers and expanders, to the ultimate drug that contracts you and makes you feel almost insensate in the womb, which is heroin.
Mm-hmm.
So they went from sensitizing drugs to completely desensitizing drugs. And of course, the climax of that is like Michael Jackson, general anesthesia. They wanted to stop feeling. You know, at the beginning, they wanted to feel more and more and more.
Alan, thank you very much for the call. And if you have a comment or a question for David Comfort, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234 as we talk about his book, The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead, published by Citadel Press. And you can visit his website, rockandrollbookofthedead.com. And the book is available, I would imagine, in most bookstores.
All the major bookstores, yes.
All right. One of the things that kind of interested me was Kurt Cobain. He seems to be the latest of these stars. And why did you include him?
I included him because he's cross-generational. The others were very much in the classic rock period. He was an ex-gen, and he was very much the cultural icon of an entire generation. And the next step in rock and roll, I suppose, which is, you know, to me, I mean, rock and roll is all about energy. But when Cobain and the whole punk thing hit, though there were many predecessors, it was all about anger and rage, which is another form of energy that becomes quite dark, you know, and can be quite consumptive.
Mm-hmm. He committed suicide or at least the...
Well, it appeared that way.
Yeah.
I'm quite convinced that it was set up to appear that way because he had made many suicidal remarks in the past, like I hate myself and I want to die, and saying I'm going to jump off these speakers or kill myself. And he also said he had suicide genes because a lot of the people in his family had off themselves or come close to it. So it's very easy to make a murder look like a suicide, and that's what I think happened here.
Let's go to Marcus next in Green Bay. Marcus, what's on your mind today?
Hello. You mentioned a little earlier that artists, the sensitivity and all that, and the drug abuse, and it, you know, you hear this all the time going way back in history, and I wondered what you thought of why artists or people who are able to express themselves, why is the drugs, the excessive drugs, why do you think that ties in with the two?
I think artists, as particularly these kind of artists, they as I said before, there's an insatiability about them. That it's, you know, they want to experience more and more and more life. I mean, they feel alive at 200 miles an hour, or at, you know, beyond that. Underneath that, they feel bored. They feel non-existent. It's just something that's intrinsic to these kind of creative personalities, I think. Also, you know, at the beginning, drugs do seem to amp creative impulses. Now, whether, you know, you look at your work the next morning after you've been on acid and it seems all like nonsense, I mean, that's a moot point. In any case, in the moment when you're taking LSD or an expander or a major drug, you just feel so much more, and they were addicted to that, you know. But it's very dangerous, of course.
So I guess to go one step further is, you know, there's many people that may abuse or whatever and don't leave things behind. Again, going way back in history, what is it sort of by a very minimum percentage of the population, it's almost accepted as, or should I say understood, that yeah. These people are like that and that they contribute to society.
Oh, sure it is, yeah. I mean, well, Janis, for example, said, maybe my audiences can enjoy my music more if they think I'm destroying myself. And there is an insidious kind of vicarious quality that the fans expect this of these people, and they love to watch it. It's like watching an aerialist working without nets. I mean, it's breathtaking. And, there's a certain romance, I suppose, to drug abuse and that sort of excessiveness. As Jim Morrison said, the path of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. I mean, they all live by that, and it's a Blake quote.
Mm-hmm. Marcus, thank you for your call, and let's go next to Rowley in Oak Creek. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. And while I was on hold, I saw somebody modern who's not a musician but an athlete, John Daly, who seems to appeal to people simply because of this life of excess, and this is constant fear that someday he's going to pass away in a tragic manner just like these others. But I first thought about Keith Moon, who was never quite the superstar, but he also died from living in excess.
Oh, he did. Yeah, he was. A lot of people say, why didn't you include Keith Moon? Well, he certainly would have been a runner-up, in addition to Brian Jones, who was that way as well. But yeah, I mean, he was over the top.
Is there others? Are there others besides Keith Moon and Brian Jones that sort of fit into this next book, maybe?
You know, there are people certainly who are still alive who I consider like rock and roll Lazaruses, who almost should have died, who were doing the same kind of thing. Of course, you know, the real archetype is Keith Richards, and then Pete Townsend. They're just very, very lucky people to still be alive. David Bowie's another, Elton John. But other people ask, well, how about Paul McCartney or Bruce Springsteen? Well, they're a horse of a different color. These guys, in addition to, for example, Mick Jagger, are very cautious. I mean, they certainly take drugs, but they're cautious and they're very concerned about staying in control. And they just never went over the edge. And also, a lot of this has to do with youth, you know. When we're kids, we're ready to go to the precipice, many of us. We're ready to jump off the cliff. And when people make it to 30, 40 and start having families, they become much more conservative, and they calm down a lot. So once a rocker reaches like 35 or 40, he's closer to the safety zone. But when you're in your 20s, it's another ballgame.
Raleigh, thank you for the call. And Detma gets the last word here. Hello, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I know a lot about the people he mentioned, but because of time, I just say that they often self-medicate, that many artists are bipolar.
Yeah.
And in German, we even have a saying, craziness and brilliance goes together.
Well, they had a bit. All of them had a big thing about being crazy, you know. And you'd imagine, well, the least crazy is Elvis Presley, right? On the other side of his on the inside of his ID bracelet, it said crazy. You know, he worshipped it. I mean, Hendrix said, "You've got to be crazy," you know. And Lennon was all of them. You know.
We've got to leave it there, David. Thank you so much for being with us and spending time with us today. I have enjoyed the book, and I hope other people do as well.
Great.
It's the Rock and Roll Book of the Dead, Citadel Press. The website is rockandrollbookofthedead.com. Our thanks to Erica Janik for on-air phone production. Tomorrow, Dennis Prusik of Green Bay will be back with the 2010 Nature Calendar. And then at 11:45, Oneida storyteller Deborah Morningstar. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.